Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Jeanette Parker, and I'm Medical Whistleblower, and I'm coming to you live from Florence, Kansas. We are an advocacy network to support and provide information to and about those who report problems within the medical community, including medical fraud, abuse and neglect of patients, and human rights violations. Today we have a very important topic to talk about, and that is mandated reporters. Most people understand that mandated reporting does occur here in the United States to try to prevent child abuse and also abuse of other vulnerable populations, including the disabled and the elderly. Under the Federal Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, CAPTA, which was passed in 1974, all the states have passed laws mandating the reporting of child abuse and neglect. Although these laws vary from state to state, each state is responsible for providing its own definition of child abuse and neglect, describing the circumstances and conditions that obligate mandated reporters to report known and suspected child abuse, and to provide definitions for juvenile and family courts as to when they should take custody of a child, and to specify the forms of maltreatment that are criminally punishable. The investigations are usually held and carried out by Child Protective Services in each state. And the intent of the law is to protect the child in the home, to provide help and resources for the parent and caretaker, and to become a catalyst for change in the home environment to prevent further risk of abuse. Although any citizen can make a report of suspected or known child abuse to the Child Protective Services, mandated reporters are required by law to make a report. Oftentimes, this requirement to be a mandated reporter is within the scope of their employment, because a mandated reporter has a special relationship or has contact with children and within the home. And numerous professions can be involved in doing a mandated report. Child care custodians like foster parents, people in the public and private schools, that includes teachers, bus drivers, administrative officers, teachers' aides, social workers, of course, law enforcement, firefighters, probation officers and parole officers, Head Start teachers, licensing workers, foster parents, people who are employees at child care institutions. But most importantly, health practitioners. Physicians, surgeons, psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health counselors, dentists, dental assistants, chiropractors, licensed nurses, optometrists, clinical social workers, EMTs and paramedics, coroners and medical examiners, public health employees, and even clergy may be involved in mandated reporting. In addition, animal control officers and people who do film and photographic print processes may be required to report. I have a couple people on the line here, and I'd like to get them on here to help me describe this problem. Hello? Are you there?
Hello?
Yes, hi. How are you doing?
And who do I have?
Yes. Okay, that must be Jerry. Okay, let me get the, I have two more people. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Dr. Jeanette, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, this is Judith Grant. How are you?
Hi, Judith. And I've got two more people. Let me get them all on here at the same time. My switchboard's blinking here. Okay.
Hey.
Hi, how are you? So I think I have on the phone here today, I have a registered nurse, Judith Grant, who's from South Dakota. And she has been a reporter of situations that were abusive that, regarding elderly persons, the persons in elder care. And I believe I also have Dr. Jerry Mills. Are you on, Jerry?
Yes, I'm here.
And Jerry Mills is a pediatrician from Rhode Island. And as a pediatrician and an MD, she, of course, trained to recognize the signs of abuse in children and adults, but specifically, Jerry works with children out of choice. She likes working with children, and so therefore that is her area of a special interest. And we have also a woman who is a foster care, was a foster care parent, and who was the head of the Rhode Island Foster Care Association, a former president of that association from Providence, Rhode Island. Are you there with me? Hello? Darlene, are you there? Darlene Barry Cabral, are you there? She doesn't seem to hear me.
Must be having some audio connection problem there, Dr. Jeanette.
Okay.
Please,
I don't know what's
back in.
I don't know what's going on. Anyway, we can start with the two of you. Do you want to go first, Jerry, and talk a little bit about how would a pediatrician, an MD, identify a situation that she might feel as a mandated reporter she would have to report?
I'd like to begin by saying, again, that what I've had to endure for the last 10 years. I took a Hippocratic oath when I became a doctor on January 22, 1984, and its primary tenet was to do no harm. I'm a mandated reporter as a pediatrician, but I've been suspended for doing exactly that, reporting what I believed was a concern of too many injuries in two girls in one family.
What kind of injuries does a pediatrician might see that would necessitate making a mandated report?
Were not actual injuries that I saw, but I was able to determine from their past records that there were skull fractures, a fractured arm, wrist, multiple surgeries on necessary need, many emergency visits, as well as inconsistent stories. And when you get inconsistent stories from parents and children, that there's a problem, and that is a high risk factor that there may be child abuse. So we're not, as reporters, mandated to make an actual claim.
It was a retrospective view of the charts and the medical records in total.
You only need to suspect something.
Mm-hmm.
Have a reasonable belief, but you don't have to prove it, and that's the work of the investigation to prove it.
Now, when you do report, they are supposed to maintain you anonymously from the person you reported, right?
That's not absolutely correct. And the National Clearinghouse on Child Abuse has talked about that. There's a woman named Cox who's written highly about that. I have an article by her sent to me by an email. And it's that they like to have you as an anonymous reporter. If I can read something really quick, the National Clearinghouse on Child Abuse and Neglect informs us of the following. When a report of child abuse and neglect is made, the names of the reporters are not given out to the families reporting for the child abuse and neglect. However, sometimes by the nature of the information reported, your identity may become evident to the family. And so the state laws in Rhode Island, they don't explicitly say that you cannot report anonymously, but if you're a physician and a patient comes to your office and you see an actual bruise or an injury, you are mandated to report it and to give your identity. And the identity is because you need to follow it up with a written report called the physician's record of examination. But the gray areas are, what do you do if the patients are no longer in your practice? What do you do if you are a suspended doctor or you've been told not to practice medicine and you find out the information after you've been told not to practice? So you're still a mandated reporter. The suspended doctor is still a doctor that needs to do their duty. And anyone, any state official who prevents you from doing the duty, there are laws against that. And that's a criminal act to prevent somebody from doing the mandated duty.
If I can...
The question of anonymity is a little bit of a gray area.
Okay.
Because no one would report if they knew that they couldn't be anonymous.
Okay. I think we have Dr. Jim Singer. Is that you, Dr.
Singer? Yes, hello.
Hello. We have Dr. Jim Singer on the line as well, and he is a therapist and works with children, and he is a trained clinical psychologist and an expert, of course, in working with the emotional side of the abuse issue, and certainly a person very knowledgeable in identifying the emotional, psychological, or sexual abuse of children. Do you want to add something there, Dr. Singer?
Yes. You're not only allowed to, you should be treated as a confidential informant because child abuse is a crime, and both the mandated reporter and the child alleged victim is supposed to be protected. But that didn't happen in my case either. And obviously, as a physician, you might be looking for injuries, but you're also mandated to report even if there are suspicions of abuse related to possible emotional abuse, which, of course, may not have any, quote, visible injuries, unquote. But you're still... obligated to report. Obviously, if there's sexual abuse, there may or may not be injuries and possibly not even physical evidence other than, I guess, a GYN examination.
There could be evidence of emotional trauma from the perspective of a therapist.
Yes. So there may be obvious trauma, which may or may not be related to other injuries.
Now, since 1990, statistics show that 52% of the child abuse reports each year are actually made by mandated reporters. And so a mandated reporter may be the only really responsible adult in that particular child's life.
Yes. And I think it's important, related to what Dr. Mills was saying, that anyone can make a report of child abuse. You're only mandated as required by law when the child comes before you in a professional capacity, which may or may not be in the home. And I guess more often may not always be in the home, of course, unless you're a foster parent or something else. But the focus and the intent is to protect the child. And obviously that does not always happen, despite the efforts of the professional.
Now, a mandated reporter who fails to make a report of a known or suspected abuse situation is guilty of misdemeanor crime and can actually be punishable, according to California statutes, it differs from state to state. But in California, they can be punished up to 6 months in jail or up to $1,000 in fines and may lose their license or their credential, thus preventing them from ever working again. So it's very serious if you don't make a report. Is that not true?
Yes. It's ironic enough that I was told by the State Attorney General's office that I definitely would have been criminally prosecuted if I did not report the suspected abuse. But although I did obey the law, and because I obeyed the law, I was caught in a catch-22 where they destroyed me. So
now, mandated reporters cannot be prevented from reporting, and they're not supposed to lose their job from making a report. But my research has shown that many mandated reporters actually have lost their jobs and their licenses because their identity has not been kept confidential. And when their identity is known to the perpetrator can make counter accusations under the Good Samaritan Act, under HICWA, the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act, and thus attack the licensure of the person who is doing the mandated reporting. Judith, can we get you in here for a moment? Judith is a registered nurse. She is from South Dakota, and she works a great deal in emergency service and also with elder care issues. Is it similar to reporting issues in regards to elder care?
Well, there certainly are, Dr. Jeanette. And hello, Dr. Singer and Dr. Mills. It's nice to meet you both on the phone. I am very much, you know, I share with you that I, too, have had repercussions and severe retaliation for having complied with the law, because the mandated reporting statutes equally apply to any vulnerable population. And as part of my practice, I'm actually a clinical nurse specialist, and I went into advanced practice and did become certified in gerontology. And in that realm, unfortunately, there's a great deal of exploitation. Not only is there, you know, abuse and exploitation on a physical level and mental level, but there's a financial element of that that is very dangerous. And 5 years ago, when I discovered this episode in relation to a friend, a family friend, you know, close person, client of mine, I did the investigation that I needed to do, then notified as I was required by law to do. And in the aftermath of that, my life has been destroyed. And I'm continuing to fight the repercussions of that even today. And it's very difficult, I think, when the general public is unaware that when you make these reports, which you are required by law to do, and you've done the right thing because you believe in your professional ethics and your professional oath, and then you are punished for it because it maybe happened to expose a powerful person or a powerful corporation. In my case, the implications of what I reported was the tip of the iceberg of this financial fraud crisis that we are dealing with today. And in those episodes, you have very little recourse because you begin to realize that the corruption can cross many lines of authority, and it can, in fact, go against a number of powerful entities that don't want anything done about it. And at that time, you begin to realize that you're kind of out there by yourself, and it's very frustrating. It's very difficult to go through that.
Now, I think that you're alluding to the fact that it is quite possible for persons to take advantage of the guardianship and conservatorship aspects of the law in order to take over someone's financial assets, to strip them of their resources, and then after they've done stealing everything from the person, just dump them off on the welfare state. And they often can do this without the knowledge and consent of persons who care about that person. So there can be a very uncaring and unjust judicial system that has helped convert a guardianship and conservatorship from an appropriate law to one which, if misused, is damaging to the general public. And it does operate to ensnare some of the most vulnerable people, including the disabled, both physically and developmentally disabled or mentally disabled persons, also the elderly, and I would assume also very, very young infants as well. It has become a feeding trough for unethical lawyers and other fiduciaries appointed by the courts that are supposed to protect, but actually become nothing more than predators to take resources from these vulnerable populations. And so the wards are not being protected by the system. They're victimized by it, and they lose their freedom, their property, sometimes their very lives. And there's a very severe lack of monitoring by individual judges and court administrators, and further lack of oversight by the courts, by state and federal legislatures.
I think this is an area, Dr. Jeanette, where really we are beginning to see that there has been a tremendous infiltration of corruption into all of these lines of authority that were put in place to do the right thing. I know when I began in my practice and I took my oath to uphold ethics and to treat my clients and my employers and everyone that I was involved with the respect that they were due, I certainly believed in the system, and I believed that there were opportunities within the system to keep the checks and balances in place that would allow all of us to be safe and to do our best work. And that has fallen apart. That does not exist in an intact way at this time. And I think that's a difficult reality for all of us, because until we fall prey to it, we don't necessarily believe that it could happen. I know I have colleagues that really are shocked when they realize what has happened to me. They still don't even want to believe that it could happen, because that's a scary thought as a professional, to realize that your life, your work, your livelihood could be decimated by an entity that doesn't want to be made accountable, and they just happen to be, powerful and have the ability to do things within the systems and to exert influence.
Well, the uncaring and corrupt judges often misuse the law, engage in blatant due process violations, and even civil and human rights violations. Dr. Jerry Mills, can you talk a little bit about that in your own case?
Yes. I happen to have gotten the knowledge about a Catherine Hine, an attorney and child advocate, mm-hmm. that Dr. Singer and I both know of. And she's pretty disenchanted at this point with the entire system. But she had written a chapter in a book by Lynn Crook, and Dr. Singer and I actually met a year ago, March 4th, in Manhattan at the United Nations, where Lynn Crook spoke. And her chapter is titled Retaliation Against Professionals to Report Child Abuse. And even though the public is not aware of this, and even I'm sure Dr. Singer and Janet and myself all probably never thought this would happen to us, It's very surreal. I mean, 10 years into being unemployed, uninsured, and being tortured, it's hard to believe for doing the right thing. And like I said at the beginning of what I spoke, I stand by it. And, I'm on the other side now. I'm not in the traumatic stage of this. And her book, the chapter actually reads, since before the time of Freud, this has been going on. And that's the line. But yes, our judicial system and our legislator, and they're all in on it. Sheldon Whitehouse, who's now our senator of Rhode Island, who's general, wrote that I made a false report of child abuse, even knowing that the family and the children were never investigated. The attorney at our medical board wrote that there was a thorough investigation when father witness, who is a child protective investigator himself at the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, there was criminal investigation. It's called a non-investigation. In retaliation against me, they are protecting the possible perpetrator of abuse, and I say possible, but I'm of the belief over 90% that the mother has Munchausen by proxy and has, you know, caused these injuries to these girls, and they may not have been physical injuries when I saw them, but they certainly probably could have been emotional. And then there were questions of inconsistent stories while I did see them about further injuries.
Mm-hmm.
Our justice system is protecting them. Our medical system and our justice system is protecting these people, and they are violating the law by doing so.
Now, I have someone else on the line, and I'd like to get that person into this discussion. Hello, are you there? Hello? You're on the line. I guess they didn't realize I turned them on. Dr. Singer, can you speak about the courts and how they did or did not do due process in your case?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I had a state policeman who had written a report indicating that there were criminal violations by government officials. And these criminal violations included official oppression, where they're using the authority of their office to commit crimes and to retaliate.
I've lost you on the line.
I can hear you now.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, it was official oppression, fabrication of evidence, and sworn falsification by government officials, and there was obstruction of justice. And I thought finally, once this report was submitted, that there would finally be an investigation, but instead the policeman was shut down, and there were numerous letters written by high-level state officials which were contrary to the state's own evidence. Due process was violated, that we weren't allowed to get subpoenas. Obviously, there was perjury that was covered up, even by the judge, had not only covered up the perjury testimony, but there was actually perjury written in the final judge's opinion and adjudication. And I've been to every prosecutorial agency in the state and federal government, and no one did anything. It's been covered up at the highest level. As a matter of fact, now that I'm thinking about it, there were 5,000 cases remanded because the state Supreme Court indicated that this due process called commingling, where the judge and the jury and the prosecutor are basically in bed together, that was a fatal defect. So there were 5,000 cases remanded, all except for one, which was mine. So those due process rights were waived.
And that's what's so very frustrating, Dr. Jeanette and the other participants. When you are doing, you know, everything you can, you're following all of the appropriate avenues, and you're pursuing things from a logical, reasonable perspective, and you're doing your best to get the correct version of things in the proper places, and they don't want to see it, they don't want to hear it, they don't want to deal with it. And that is that sense of violation, that betrayal of our trust in this system that we are protecting, is a very serious violation. You know, Dr. Mills, you mentioned it's torture. It is torture. There are very serious retaliation measures being taken against responsible, good, ethical healthcare professionals today that really include measures that meet the criteria for torture. And that's a strong statement, but we have to make sure that the American people begin to hear that. Because if you can't protect us for doing the right thing and protecting you, then how are we to be expected to continue? And will people continue? I don't think that's a fair expectation of good healthcare professionals. It really isn't.
Victims of these crimes are often in a situation where they're held under an incarceration. You know, they're in a mental health facility. They could be in a prison situation, juvenile detention situation. When there are questions about competency of the victim, like an elderly person who's they're accusing of not being competent, or a mentally ill person, or a person developmentally disabled in some way, the victims aren't always given notice of the hearings at which their competence will be adjudicated. They're not always allowed to attend. They often don't have a lawyer to represent them properly. And if the court does appoint lawyers, those lawyers are often too closely affiliated with the other professionals who make their living in the specialty area.
Yes.
And do not properly represent the victim's interests. They often represent the other side's interests. And corrupt judges often do not apply the required evidentiary standards in making adjudications of incompetency, and frequently fail to obey the protective statutes and include specific findings of fact. And so for those reasons, the victims are stripped of their civil rights and often of their human rights. And you can imagine how a victim feels if they've been repeatedly abused physically, emotionally, or sexually, to have their rights taken away and then guardianship assigned to someone they don't trust.
It is very, very frightening to think that in our society, which we, you know, we represent the free world to the world here in the United States, and yet we have problems that are very serious that are not getting the appropriate level of attention. And I think the reason is that we have gotten to a place where the, you know, the overriding dictum here in our country is about money. And there's a lot of money in abuse, let's face it. People are making money exploiting children. They're making money exploiting the elderly and other vulnerable populations. And because of that, these protections are just moot at this point. They don't mean anything. And we really must become much more active and effective in helping to bring forward the awareness of this so that we can get the kind of participation from all the echelons that really need to get involved to try to straighten out the problems. You know, there are good people in law enforcement, good people in the judiciary, good people in healthcare, good people in all of these echelons, but they don't really know the problem exists, or they're too frightened to become involved in trying to fix it. I've had that experience.
These fiduciaries have power of life and death over the people that they control. They can actually bury their wards in a nursing home, keep them chemically restrained with unnecessary and dangerous drugs. Family members are denied access to them or any say in their care, sometimes even denied visitation.
It's horrible. My story is such a nightmare.
Yeah, it can be a nightmare. And we saw this kind of abuse with children in substance abuse treatment centers and juvenile detention centers. We've had children held and repeatedly raped while held in the detention and denied access to their families, denied access to the outside world, and all under the acts of some guardian who was controlling them. Can you step in here for a moment, Jerry Mills?
Yeah, this is a question. Obstruction of evidence is a huge part of this. And what do you do when it hits the level of, you know, your superior court, your Supreme Court judges who obstruct evidence? In my particular case, the oldest girl had a near-SIDS event, which is a near-death event, sometime during her infancy. And the parents concealed the records, and we tried to subpoena them through the court system, and the justice system and the highest judges denied the subpoena. And that's supposed to be allowed in any suspect cases of child abuse. The second girl had a skull fracture, and so now you're dealing with an apneic event, cessation of breathing, and then another child with a skull fracture. And those are significant injuries, and put them together, you've got something that needs to be investigated. But if the highest judiciary is going to support the perpetrators, where do you go from there?
You bring up a very valuable point, and I think there are I know there are organizations that do some work along these lines. I've become aware of a couple of them. But in terms of identifying for individual citizens the kinds of judicial influences that are occurring, for instance, the one organization, HALT, H-A-L-T, does a report on the judiciaries in different states. And for, in South Dakota, for instance, where you know I've lived since I returned to the Midwest, I used to live in California, here in South Dakota, there's no limit on the amount of influence that corporations can give judges in terms of paying them for trips and gifts and so on and so forth. There's no limit on that. Imagine that. There's no limit. How are they supposed to be able to be objective when they can be wined and dined and all kinds of influence provided by these very wealthy corporations that are involved in making money from the very situations that we're describing? So that's where the problem is.
In one situation in Atlanta, the Marsh facility in Atlanta, Georgia, the Marsh part of the name stood for Judge Marsh, who was the judge in that district and who ordered the juveniles to take their treatment at that center, of which he was a major owner. And so the judge was getting direct payback for forcing young people and other prisoners in his court system into that facility and keeping them for extended period of time until their insurance money or their parents' money ran out, and thereby getting a whole lot of money into his own pockets. And I think we had two judges who were just indicted for receiving kickbacks, throwing juveniles into the juvenile prison system. Wasn't that in your state, Judith?
No, that was out in Pennsylvania. But I have raised serious questions about some of the things, and it has been highlighted here in South Dakota. We did have a case about 10 years ago of a juvenile female, 14 years old, who died just a couple of days after she arrived at the juvenile detention facility. And it was a very serious crime, and there's been many allegations that have come forward since that time, and that facility was closed as a result of that because of the abuse of staff members against the juveniles. And these are the kinds of things that are happening. They're happening all the time, and I have very serious concerns about some of the psychiatric facilities here from personal experience.
That facility was a boot camp kind of situation.
Right,
and
it was a boot camp,
they
right.
They put her through this kind of a juvenile boot camp thing, and they killed her. But then they turned around and turned it into a psychiatric center, and they're still keeping people in that facility.
Dr. Janet and Dr. Jim, there's another situation that's really important, and those are these expert witnesses. In my case, an expert witness pediatrician from Rhode Island Children's Hasbro Hospital testified, and he was asked that exact question. If the patient's no longer in your care, how do you make PRE? You can't. You cannot make a physician's record of examination as a follow-up. And so then he was asked, well, what would you do then? And his answer was, well, I guess the state
you're fading out there, Jerry. Can you? I just lost you.
There's really there's very little follow-up of any of these allegations, because there is no intact system for really monitoring and keeping things going. And I think we have to look at being able to get something that is more effective established. As I think Dr. Singer brought out in his story, that, you know, that when you get to the highest levels and these things are being, and as well as, you know, Dr. Mills talking about, when you get to the very highest levels within your state jurisdiction, and there's an unwillingness to cooperate in the right kind of investigation and evidence review, then where do you go? And that's where we get into trouble, because that's something that I'm just, you know, I'm working on now, in the sense that the federal courts are limited in what they can take over from the state courts for jurisdiction issues. And it does get to be a very difficult situation when you have a system in the state where you live that is compromised and is getting rewarded very handsomely for keeping things exactly the way they are.
And then we asked ourselves about the jurisdiction of the federal system in regards to human rights. Because sometimes these abuses involve the use of Medicaid and Medicare money. They may involve the prison system that may be federally funded. It may involve foster children that receive Title IV-E federal funds. And so there may be a federal jurisdiction on some of these cases, but not all, of course. But there should be protections at the level of the federal system for prevention of abuse, but unfortunately they aren't enforced adequately.
And I think that you've just hit on the really key point, is, you know, we do have laws that govern these matters. They're not enforced. Just like we had guidelines that would have prevented a great deal of this financial fraud, they were not enforced. And that's something that I think has happened because we as citizens, ordinary citizens, have become less aware and less able to understand the way the laws work, the way the laws are written. Stop and think about who's in our legislatures. There's a great number of the positions that are occupied by lawyers, and they are writing laws that are legally difficult for the average citizen to understand the implications of. And I think that has to be looked at, because it begins to set aside the concept of checks and balances when you have too great of an emphasis coming from just one perspective. You know, we have fine lawyers, don't get me wrong. There's many fine lawyers out there, but there's also some that have chosen to use their skills in the promotion of entities that aren't necessarily doing the right thing.
So we have somebody on the line who's from New Jersey. Are you there? I guess they don't want to join us. Okay. Jim.
Yes.
Dr. Singer, can you speak a little bit about where you think we should go to fix the problem here?
Well, I wish I had some answers. There needs to be, I would think, some kind of national task force. It's my understanding that there are some bills currently in Congress, actually House Resolution 1507 and Senate Bill 372, I believe. But the problem is that they're only covering federal employees. And it's my understanding that President Obama's administration is recommending some kind of task force rather than having cases brought to court. But we need to ensure integrity in those bodies as well. So I don't have any answers. Unfortunately, and maybe I might like to refer to the rest of you, I've been on national television, ABC World News, with Peter Jennings, and unfortunately, soon thereafter, there was a child who was severely beaten with internal injuries, and there was a nurse, not just a lay person, who was a neighbor who suspected that there was abuse. And the nurse apparently indicated that she was afraid to report because she would lose her job or her license.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the child died.
And I think that is happening, Dr. Singer, more than we realize. Because it's not just in our healthcare professions, but I have even had attorneys that know, because my case is just blatant violation of the law. It's the corruption. It's just so apparent. It's horrifying. But I've had attorneys right here in our state tell me they're too afraid to help me. And that is a scary thing.
Yes.
Yeah, because the judges that are corrupt are very, very powerful. And, of course,
Absolutely.
Attorneys have to deal with those judges all the time. And so it makes it very difficult.
So it does make it very difficult.
And so when we can't go to our state court system, we may not be able to get access to the federal court system, and therefore, we don't have any protection under the Constitution. Of course, our U.S. Constitution is supposed to protect us from abuse. You know, there are acts in our Constitution that describe our rights in regards to that. And Dr. Jim Singer, you were talking to me previously about the UN Declaration of the Rights of the Child.
Yes.
As a being an important human rights document put together by the United Nations, and the President of the United States has not yet signed that document. The U.S. has only ratified 3 of the 16 documents in the human rights area that have been put forward by the United Nations. But you would probably urge the president to sign that document and the Congress to ratify it?
Yes. One of the panelists on today's show assumed that the United States is an example of liberty and justice for all. It sounds like the Pledge of Allegiance here. But unfortunately, that may not necessarily be the case, and it's unfortunate that the United Nations treaty, as I understand it, has been ratified by almost every nation member of the United Nations except for two.
And which two are they?
Those two are Somalia and the United States.
Oh, we're in great company, aren't we?
Yes, very good company. Excuse my sarcasm.
Well, I think that is something that perhaps needs to be made, again, more awareness if we can, to begin to educate people. Because, yes, we keep hearing about, how great our country is. And I say that as well with a bit of sarcasm, because we keep hearing about we have the greatest healthcare system in the world. We don't have the best outcome data to support those statements. We have, outcome data in certain areas where we really excel, but in so many areas we are worse than third world countries. And, when people get their news in commercials and sound bites, and that's really how they get informed, they don't bother to really become better informed by checking the sources and looking at who's paying for what in terms of getting those opinions out there. I think that's a dangerous way that Americans have learned to cope, and it's going to hurt them in the long run very deeply.
Yes.
Dr. Jerry Mills, what do you think we can do to change this problem that we have in regards to mandated reporters and lack of due process and retaliation?
Well, I actually think that starting at the lower level in each of our states would be helpful. And I can cite Dr. Agliano and Dr. William Luria of Hillsborough County Medical Association, I believe that's the name, in Hillsborough, I believe it's Florida, have started thing with a police expert witnesses. And they have said that it's their breach and their dishonest testimony is actually compared to that of malpractice. So we need to have checks and balances right at our own level about each of our own doctors. And because for a price or for whatever their reason is, maybe, you know, a fear of retaliation against them if they don't speak out against another. In my case, there were two physicians at Rhode Island Hospital who were involved in this dishonest obstruction of evidence. And one is a child abuse expert. And so, you know, how could a person do that? How could a person spend their life's work on apnea and head injury and then go in and obstruct evidence knowingly? So, you know, I think we need to start at that level. And, you know, these organizations are easy to form. It's just a group of doctors who are willing to speak out. And I think that they do have a federal case going in Florida from that society. So that's...
Well, I guess we have to probably wrap up here because we're getting to the end of our hour. I'd like to let everyone know that there is a National Association to Stop Guardian Abuse in Mount Prospect, Illinois, and that they have a website, www.stopguardianabuse.org, and that's a good place to go. And if you are interested in information about mental health rights, the Psychiatric Law Project in Anchorage, Alaska is a very good place to get information, and that's psychrights.org. And of course, I'm Dr. Jeanette Parker, and I am coming to you live from Lawrence, Kansas, and we are an advocacy group for persons reporting problems within the medical community that involve medical fraud, abuse and neglect of patients, and human rights violations. And of course, when we do not protect our mandated reporters and give them proper due process when they are facing retaliation, we clearly don't have a system that protects any of us. And all of us could at any time become a vulnerable person who might potentially become prey to persons who might want to abuse us. And that's certainly true as we get to the end of our lives and get elderly. And it's also true should we have an accident or mishap or illness that makes us a vulnerable person. Do any of you have any last-minute things to say?
Yes, Dr. Jeanette, can you mention some of our whistleblower sites? Because that's basically what we are. We're medical and environmental whistleblowers.
What was it you wanted me to talk about?
Mentioning some of the internet sites, the websites for the medical and environmental whistleblowers.
Well, there are several organizations that help us with whistleblowers. One is the Governmental Accountability Project in Washington, D.C. Also, the National Whistleblower Center, POGO, P-O-G-O, is another one, and also the International Whistleblowers Association. Is there any others you would like to mention, Dr. Mills?
I believe is it the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons?
Oh, AAPS, yes. Mm-hmm.
And there's also Texas Medical Board Watch.com. And the Alliance for Patient Safety.org.
Okay. So then there's also Semmelweis, international.net.
Maybe we can subsequently respond via email because I know Jeanette's time is fleeting.
Running out here. Okay,
yes.
We have got 5 minutes to go. So
I don't know, you know, Jeanette, what recommendations do you have? I know that you've tried to get some changes, and what recommendations do you have that might help?
Myself, as the host, I have felt that the United States should be more cognizant of the problems we face in front of the courts, the lack of due process, especially at the administrative courts that are involved in licensing issues for medical professionals, because that retaliation at the level of your medical license is one way in which perpetrators do try to silence doctors. And unfortunately, that system is a blind system in regards to the targeted doctor being able to know what is being held against them and being able to adequately mount a defense when they are targeted. The other problem I see is a lack of law enforcement of the Title 18 provisions of the Civil Rights Code, which allows law enforcement to enforce criminal sanctions against persons who do obstruction of justice, tampering with evidence, intimidation of witnesses, and those kinds of things. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen very frequently, that we get good protection in those areas. And then thirdly, I would say that the United States needs to be cognizant of the ethical and moral values of the international community and to support the UN Declaration of Human Rights documents. There are 16 documents, and I think the documents that are important here are the one that the president just signed on July 30th, which was the UN Convention regards to the rights of the disabled. But I also wanted to point out, as you had before brought to my attention, Dr. Singer, the UN Convention in regards to rights of the child, and also the UN Convention in regards to rights to women, because sexual abuse is one of the major issues in front of us. So those are the kinds of things that I think should be changed or should be worked on.
And Dr. Jeanette, perhaps we can continue to use the wonderful forum that you've created with the Medical Whistleblower website that you have, in terms of you know, finding some arenas in which people can explore with some, you know, accuracy and direction these very difficult issues and begin to get some interaction. I think having others to network with is just a vital, because, you know, it's a vital process, and we need to have that. I know when you are isolated, it's very easy to be, you know, to be targeted even more severely. So I think we do have to continue to be more in contact with others who are likewise of interest in these areas and who have also been targeted, perhaps.
And I'd like to remind everyone that Medical Whistleblower is coming to you live on Blog Talk Radio on Monday at 9 a.m. And I believe we will be talking at that moment about foster care and abuse within the foster care system. So I thank you all for listening to my show, and I thank all my guests for being with me. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you for having us.
And anyone who wishes to communicate with me here at Medical Whistleblower, my email is medicalwhistleblower@gmail.com. And anyone else want to leave their contact information?
I'm going to follow up with you through Medical Whistleblower, Dr. Jeanette. And,
okay.
And I'm grateful to have had an opportunity to speak with both Dr. Singer and Dr. Mills today, and to get some insight into their situations as well.
It was wonderful having you all. You were great.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.